It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're cooking up some brownies for Food Friday. Whether you like them fudgy or cakey, we'll cover it all with the author of a new cookbook all about brownies.
First, when you hear the phrase personal finance, what comes to mind? For our next guest, the answer isn't stress or pulling my hair out or mountains of debt. It's actually hope.
It can make us anxious when we think about managing our money in the short or long term.
But our guest says that the anxiety just makes things worse. She wants to teach us how to tackle the fear and the dread and harness hope to make personal finance manageable.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What stresses you out most about managing your finances? Does the stress and anxiety keep you from managing your money? How do you handle the anxiety? Have you found ways to be more positive in the ways that you handle saving, paying off debt, and more? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Emily Birkin is a financial coach and co-author of the book Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. She'll be speaking at the Bayshore Barnes & Noble in Milwaukee tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. She's also giving talks at the Wauwatosa Public Library on Sunday and at Mystery to Me in Madison next Tuesday. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Emily, I know a big part of your writing and your work is making personal finance a more positive experience to people. I'm curious, what made you zero in on hopefulness as an important part of that?
I can remember talking to a friend several years ago, because I've been writing about money for over a decade now, and was saying, making this joke saying that his retirement plan is just assuming that climate change is going to make retirement impossible. You know, the oceans will rise, the temperatures will rise, you know, everything will be chaos and there's no way he's going to retire. And that's his retirement plan. And he was saying it in a way to be funny. You know, this was not, you know, defeatist or anything like that. He really was making a joke. But there's a kernel of truth in that joke. And I remember being very saddened by this joke. And I've seen other people repeat it. And I realized that what worried me about it was that it was showing a lack of hope. And so the obvious lack of hope is about climate change. You know, this friend of mine is, you know, feeling cynical about our ability to make changes to improve things in the world. But there was also a lack of hope in terms of his ability to navigate a financial system that is confusing and opaque and feels overwhelming. And I realized that having hope, not only for your own personal situation and saying, you know what, this is like my retirement plan. I don't understand what I'm doing, but I believe, I hope that I can master this and provide myself with a future that I want to live in. That is not only makes for a better situation for your personal life, but it also means that you're doing the work on a day-to-day basis to improve things for climate change as well. So if you are saying, I don't feel hope about this, then you're not going to take the small efforts that you can do to improve your own situation and improve the greater situation. And that's whether that's, you know, a big, difficult problems like climate change, like, you know, warfare, I mean, hunger, I mean, all of those things. If you say, like, this is inevitable, there's no way we're around it, you kind of lose the opportunity to take some responsibility for the little portion that you could do. And then it also means that you are not feeling the hope to make things better for yourself. So hope is often kind of denigrated as naive or unserious. I know that I have always been a very optimistic and hopeful person, and there have been times where people will kind of act as though that means I don't really know what's going on. I find there's a similar thing happens when, because my new book, Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management, takes a very humorous and lighthearted tone. And there's this sense with humor as well, that if something is humorous, then it can't be serious. And in both cases, I don't think that that's correct. I think that when you take something seriously, you have hope, you look at it with humor, you are poised to be in a better position to actually affect the change that you care deeply about, as opposed to thinking that to be serious, you need to be cynical.
And I think a lot of us have probably heard some version of your friend's comment.
Yes.
Either said or heard things like, I'll never be able to retire or own a house. That's just a pipe dream. When we kind of throw up our hands and think that way, how does that translate into some negative financial decisions?
So when you're thinking, you know, there's no way I'll ever retire, then you don't do the very little things that you can do. So I worked with a woman once who said, you know, I'm not bothering to save for retirement because I want to enjoy the money now when I'm young. And I remember at the time thinking like, well, I can't slap her silly, we're at work. I was thinking like, she was looking at this as this huge thing that she was going to have to give something up, and it was going to make things tough for her now. And she couldn't connect with her older self who was going to need this money. And so she was giving up the opportunity of saying like, you know what, I can't afford much, but I can send $25 a week into my 401k. You know, I can't afford much, but I can, you know, when I get my tax refund, put half of it into 401k or an IRA. And so hope gives you the space to find little solutions. And when it comes to any major undertaking, it's not one big push. You know, it's not a movie where you're going to get the group together and you're going to fight Thanos and everything's going to be fixed at the end. It's lots and lots and lots of little decisions that add up and compound over time. And so having hope is the way that you open up yourself to see these little decisions and these opportunities in the small moments to say, you know what, I have $500 I wasn't expecting. I can put $300 of it in my 401k. Or you know what, I got a raise. If I plan on 1% of it going to my 401k, that is going to make a difference. Whereas if you're thinking there's no way I can do this, you will never make those decisions.
We're talking to Emily Guy Birkin right now, financial coach and co-author of the book Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. Emily, something you write about in your book, a red flag that you mention is avoiding financial information because it might put a damper on your day. I know I've been there too. A deadline is looming. I need to think about something. I feel that dread and that tension coming up. But in the end, information is power, and having those numbers in front of you and understanding them is helpful. Can you talk about the types of information that we should be willing to look at and plan with?
So there's a lot of information that we would prefer not to think about. And so, you know, you often see this with money where people are like, oh my goodness, I don't even want to look at my bank balance. I don't want to look at my credit card balance. I don't want to look at, you know, what my investments have done as things have been a roller coaster recently. And it's understandable we have that. We also have the similar thing where, you know, probably a lot of us recently, as we're, you know, finally kind of coming out of the pandemic somewhat, we're like, I don't want to step on a scale after all the pandemic snacking I've been doing. Or even if you weren't able to go to the dentist for 10 years, like, I do not want to go to the dentist and find out what's wrong. The problem is the information is there whether or not you know it. You know, like the cavities are there, whether or not you know they're there. The you know, a little extra padding is there, whether or not you know the exact number. And your bank balance, your credit card balance, what's going on with your investments, that's there, whether or not you know it. And it is always better to have information and make decisions from a place of knowledge than to continue to, you know, just pull the wool over your own eyes and pretend it's not there. And so it may take some psyching up to do to get to the point where you're like, okay, I'm ready. But recognizing that even the act of like, I don't want to know this, saying like, you know what, I'm just going to go look. I'll take 3 minutes to look what's going on with my bank balance. Now, generally what's going to happen is that's going to activate you to do something because you look at your bank balance and you're like, oh my goodness, that I have to, you know, I don't have enough to cover rent. Where can I get that? And you start answering questions. But when you say to yourself, I'm just going to look, going to look for 3 minutes. If there's no problems, I can close it again. That releases you of the sense that you have to like fix something huge, which is why it's scary to get this information. You know, release yourself of that sense that it is up to you to fix everything all at once. You're just getting information. And having that information in your head at moving forward is going to be helpful. And it gets a lot easier to check that information over and over again once you've kind of ripped that Band-Aid off the first time.
We're talking to Wisconsin-based financial coach Emily Guy Birkin about how to feel less dread and more hope when it comes to personal finance.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have any tips for making big money decisions, how to tackle debt, how to invest, making those decisions easier? How did you manage stress and anxiety when it comes to personal finances? Have you had those moments, like Emily was talking about, where you just didn't want to see those numbers? How did you get past that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Dean Kinnetter. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with financial coach Emily Guy Birkin about how to feel more hopeful when it comes to your finances.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have a moment in your life where you confronted your finances, figured out how to try to get them into order, maybe overcame that fear and anxiety? Or do you have a question about how to do that right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And let's take a caller. We have John with us in Sauk City. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you? What do you want to bring up?
Good. Well, I was just listening and I remembered this little anecdote from one of my college professors in a calculus class. And he had said we were probably talking about compound interest or something, and he said it's easy to make your kids rich, and you know his point was that, you know, invest early and let that compounding, you know, build over time. Sure. And I just thought that was an interesting little anecdote.
Absolutely, John. Thanks for the call. And Emily, something you mentioned in your writing on being hopeful with personal finance is that this is also kind of a responsibility to ourselves and others in our family, maybe like our children, to start planning mm-hmm. for the future.
To John's point, like one of the things that there's an adage that, you know, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is right now. Mm. And I'm thinking about when you are hopeful for the future, that's when you plant trees. When you're hopeful for the future, that's when you put money in a 529 for your children in a 401k. And that allows you to take advantage of that kind of compound interest. And I think of hope as a responsibility, because hopelessness allows us to say, there's nothing I can do, so I won't do anything. Now, when people feel hopeless, like one of the things I want to be very careful about is, you know, when you feel hopeless, I don't want, you know, someone coming along saying like, you're doing it wrong. You should feel hope. I want people to more think about like, why are they feeling hopeless? What control do they have over that feeling? And what can they do to kind of reclaim that hope? And not only when I talk about responsibility, not only in the sense of like, that's our responsibility to our future selves and to our children and things like that, but also in the sense that it gives you agency again. You know, you are have a responsibility. You have agency to make this change and bring about the world you want to live in, whether that's, you know, in a personal sense and creating the financial world that you want your family to experience, but also in the much more global sense, in what kind of community do you want to live in? What kind of world do you want to live in? And are you doing little things on a daily basis that can compound to help bring that about, rather than allowing yourself to be overwhelmed by hopelessness?
In one area in particular that I think can feel especially hopeless or intimidating for people right now is the housing market. In a lot of places, mm-hmm. housing prices are pretty high. And if you're planning on buying a house or maybe starting a family, that can seem like a heavy lift. I'm wondering, Emily, what advice you have for people in that situation that want a house but are a little intimidated right now?
So things are really nuts right now. I mean, there's a very good reason why people may feel intimidated. You know, we're seeing these housing prices just go through the roof. And, you know, people are getting priced out of houses. And you're also seeing houses selling with these ridiculous situations. There was something that went viral the other day. There was a house that comes with a person in the basement.
Oh, my goodness.
the new owner will have to evict them because the seller is like, I don't even want to deal with this tenant who I can't evict. And so, yeah, of course, that's going to be really overwhelming. And so one of the things that I think is important is for people to remember the right house at the right price will come along at the right time for the vast majority of people. So if it's not the right price, then it's not the right house. And if this is not the right time, you know, so it is okay for you to continue to rent and economize in other places while you set money aside for, you know, to own a home later, or focus on other parts of your life, and recognize that you're not in a race. There is no finish line that you're trying to get to, like, all right, I got it. And I got everything in the right order. I got the marriage, then the house, then the babies, then, you know, and all of that. Recognize that you can do things out of order, quote unquote, and you can wait for the right home at the right price at the right time when you're in the right financial place and, you know, you're in the right place in terms of your career and where you are settling and all of those things. One of the reasons why the housing market can get so overwhelming is that it is much like the stock market in that it ebbs and flows, and people will kind of jump on things because they see, oh, it's hot right now, or there is a lot of demand right now. Now, obviously, it's not quite that simple, but for people who are just looking to get into housing right now, if you're okay, you know, where you are in your apartment, or even if you want to upgrade to a different rental or something like that, there's no rush. There is no reason that you have to get a house right now.
We're talking with financial coach Emily Guy Birkin right now about the value of being hopeful in our personal financial planning. And I want to go back to the phones now at 800-642-1234. We've got Terry in Milwaukee with us. Hi, Terry.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. I wanted to tell a short story about the importance of investing when you're young. Back in 1972 and 73, I worked as a police officer for a smaller department in southwestern Wisconsin. I was there for 2 years. I left there, and now I'm 71 years old. Last year, I got a call from the state retirement fund that they'd been searching for me because I had money in the fund. I asked them, well, how do you figure? They said, well, you worked for the police department in southwestern Wisconsin in 1972 and 73, correct? I said, yes. The woman said, did you know that they were putting money in a retirement fund for you for those 2 years? I said, no, I had no idea. They never told me that. I said, how much did they put in? She said, $356. My comment to her was, why are you trying to reach me? It seems like you're spending a lot of time and money for $356. She said, sir, that money was compounded every year. We kept investing it. You have $52,000 in that account today.
Wow.
I was just absolutely flabbergasted. When I hung up the phone with her, I called all of my grandchildren. I told them, start investing now.
Wow. Terry, I'm glad that worked out for you, and thank you for sharing that with us. Emily, that sounds like a great example of a little goes a long way.
It really is. That's an amazing story. I love hearing that. Something that I wish more of us understood younger is how the effect of compounding works over time. I can recall my ninth grade social studies teacher, Mr. Bosley, tried to teach us that. And he had us take the example of, and he chose two kids from class as an example, and he just happened to pick me as one of them, saying like, okay, so Emily starts working at age 18, and she puts aside $500 a year until she turns 40. And keeps it invested at X percentage per year. And then her classmate, Joe, flow, starts investing at age 40, keeps investing all the way, and he's investing $1,000 and keeps investing until age 65. And they both retire at age 65, and Emily has more money than Joe. Because of the way compounding works. And I remember that lesson, but I don't remember the urgency of it. You know, that was something I like, it was kind of in the back of my head, like, yeah, starting early is important. But it seems like because of the way that our brains are wired, we often don't really understand the urgency of it until we get to a point where we're like, oh, I should have done that yesterday. And so that's something I try to tell people, you know, like if all you can do is 10 bucks every pay period, do it, because 10 years from now, it's going to be worth so much more than the 10 bucks that you lost out of your each paycheck. But we have trouble seeing how that works. You know, in foresight, you know, it's in hindsight that it's like Terry's story like that. It's much easier to see in hindsight than it is to see moving forward.
And Emily, in our last few moments, I know you and your co-author are on tour right now, talking with folks about Stacked. Where can people in Wisconsin see you?
So I am going to be at the Bayshore Barnes & Noble in Milwaukee tomorrow, Saturday at 1:30 p.m. I will be at the Wauwatosa Library on Sunday at 1 p.m. And then we will be in Madison at Mystery to Me Bookstore on Tuesday. And I apologize, I'm blanking on exactly when. I believe it's at 6:30 p.m. but we are having these wonderful conversations. There's a lot of laughter, a lot of good financial advice, and you get to see my co-author and I banter and really enjoy ourselves meeting all of you.
Well, Emily, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Emily Guy Birkin is a financial coach based in Wisconsin and co-author of the book Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management.
Coming up after the news, think outside the box of brownie mix on Food Friday. We'll learn how baking brownies from scratch is easier and more creative than you might have thought. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. Coming up, Governor Evers rolled out a new clean energy plan this week. We take a look at some of what's in the plan and compare it with plans in other states.
Now, there's a lot of variety in the world of brownies. You can keep it simple or get really creative.
On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest has lots of ideas for making great brownies and blondies with different textures and flavors.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make brownies from scratch, or do you have a favorite box mix you go with? What's your favorite brownie recipe? What makes the perfect brownie for you? Fudgy? Cakey? Which do you like the most? Call 800-642-1234. What's the best brownie you ever had? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Leah Hislop is a food and lifestyle editor and writer and deputy editor at Waitrose Food Magazine. Her books include Made in London and her latest, The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between. Leah, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Leah, you say right at the top of your book that you can basically mark out the passage of time in your life with brownie memories. Can you talk a little bit about why you love brownies so much and why you see them as a good dessert?
Of course. I mean, I think they've kind of got a special place in the hearts of lots of us, haven't they, really? I think they're kind of a unique thing in baking. I always think that they're kind of like indulgent and treaty, but also kind of really homely and comforting at the same time. And there's not many things that do that. And I just love their versatility. I think you can kind of, you know, have them really simple, or you can kind of dress them up really fancy. If you're a keen cook, they're just like an amazing blank canvas for you to do whatever you want with them. So I love them. And yeah, when I started writing this book, I felt that I could kind of look back through life and see lots of moments where brownies had made a difference.
one key decision to make when you're making brownies is, do you want them dense and fudgy or a little more fluffy and cakey? First of all, what is it in our recipe and our cooking style that makes the difference between those two things?
It's a kind of combination of things, but in general, it's kind of proportion of chocolate, sugar, fat, really, in comparison to flour. So a cakey brownie will be a little bit less indulgent on the chocolate and the butter, and it will probably have more flour in it, so it's got a bit more of kind of gluten structure going on. It can also be a bit to do with how long you cook them. I love both styles, actually. Like, people get very very opinionated on the subject of fudgy versus cakey, but you know, I think there's a place for all of them.
And Leah, I understand from your book that one American icon that had very clear feelings on at least flour content in brownies was Katharine Hepburn.
Oh, yeah. Katharine Hepburn was a big fan of the brownie, which I really enjoy as a piece of trivia. And there's just this great story about her meeting someone and writing them a little note, which gave them some advice for life. And I can't quite remember exactly what it was, but it was like, number one, be yourself. Number two, something, something. Number three, don't put too much flour in your brownies, which I really enjoy. And it's good advice.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Leah Hislop about her new cookbook, The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between. You can join in with your favorite brownies or your brownie-related questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I make a brownie. It's a very dense brownie. And then once that's cool, I make a homemade caramel sauce that thickens up when it cools. I pour that over the brownie. And then when that's cool, I whip up a homemade batch of marshmallows and I pour that over. And that's like a good inch and a half thick marshmallow on top of all that. And then drizzle that with some of the caramel sauce and chocolate. And it is really good.
Well, you had me with that brownie with caramel, marshmallow, and chocolate on top of it. Is this something you make all the time, Lisa, or is this your like special occasion brownies?
Well, I only used to make it once in a while, and now I have people requesting it. And you can't eat it. You know, you have to cut them small because they're very rich, but they are just the best.
Oh, I'll cut them as big as I want. Lisa, thanks for that. Now, in your book, Leah, you offer a lot of different toppings and other things that can go into or on top of brownies. What are some of your favorite combos?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you've got to develop 52 brownie recipes for a book, you go pretty mad by the end of it. so I've got all sorts of things. I've got one of my favorites is one that's kind of inspired by Scotland. So it's got kind of bits of fudge in it, bits of shortbread.
Some haggis. And a good, oh, no, wait.
Yeah, a bit of, absolutely. No, I'm joking. good splash of whiskey, though. And then I've got my hangover brownies, which are maple syrup and bacon, which is, you know, classic combo. But yeah, there's everything in there, really, from the weird to the wonderful.
And Leah, you passed us along a few recipes. We have those up on our website at WPR.org/Food Friday. And let's start with classic 101. This is in, you know, the section of your book, Brownies for Every Day, the ultimate fudgy brownies. What are the secrets to putting this together?
So this is kind of, the sort of first recipe in the book. It's my blueprint. And I do love it very dearly. It took me a long time to get to kind of the point where I was completely happy with it. So my kitchen was just full of chocolate and, you know, crumbs for weeks while I tried to get my head around it. But in the end, it's super fudgy. So there's a lot of chocolate in it, about 300 grams, plenty of sugar, eggs. I always add an extra, I quite often add an extra egg yolk because it just kind of adds a little bit of extra richness. And I often do a mix of flour and cocoa powder because you might think you don't need cocoa powder if you've got melted chocolate in a brownie, but actually it kind of brings another dimension of chocolatiness to it, I always think, a kind of deeper flavor. So I quite often have a little bit of that. And you can do that at home if you have a recipe that's usually flour. If you swap a bit out for cocoa powder, I think it makes a difference.
You can find that recipe and a couple others at WPR.org/Food Friday. Okay, Leah, I usually make my brownies in a rectangular glass, you know, baking dish. You go square. Talk about your favorite kind of brownie baking tin.
Yeah, I go square. I find it just kind of a nice, manageable size. And I use at home, I use a loose bottom tin because I find that really useful. You know, you're not kind of like trying to prise it out of a tin where it's stuck. And I always recommend using a metal tin, preferably a kind of pale metal tin. I find it cooks a bit more evenly than glass or ceramic. Not quite sure of the science of that, but I tend to find you get a better result with a metal tin.
And Leah, you lay out a few kind of four key steps, four key elements to making a brownie. Could you walk us through those? What are sort of the core elements of making a brownie if we're thinking about it very simply?
Yeah, well, if you think about a cake, you know, usually you start by creaming butter and sugar together, and that gets kind of air in and you get that light fluffiness. You don't want to do that with a brownie, right? You want kind of dense fudge a lot of the time. So instead, it starts in a different way where you're melting butter and chocolate together. After that, you're kind of adding your sugar and your eggs. I quite often use a beater once I've put the eggs in. I find if you give it a good kind of whiz, it tends to help get that kind of lovely crust on top, you know, that kind of beautiful, crackly, crinkly top you get on really nice brownies. So I often do that. And then last but not least, you're folding in your flour and your cocoa if you're using it. And you do that pretty gently. And that's a good time to add some salt as well. I always think salt makes a lot of difference to brownies.
We heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Marsha, who writes, "My favorite brownie is a from-scratch recipe that's more of a baked fudge beyond rich." And Marsha says, "My first baking experience was a blondie recipe I learned in home economics class." Is there a magical dividing line, Leah, between fudge and a really fudgy brownie?
Magical dividing line. That's a good question. Depends how long you bake it, I think, a lot of the time. I always recommend fridging my brownies, which not everyone does. But if you like fudginess, it kind of just firms it up. Somehow you put a kind of squishy brownie in the fridge and it goes kind of firm and very fudge-like. Again, the science of that is a mystery to me, but I really recommend it. That easier to cut as well.
It's Food Friday. Leah Hislop is with us. Her new cookbook is called The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite variations on the brownie? How about blondies? What brownie successes or failures have you had in the kitchen? Our guest is here to help you troubleshoot and get some ideas for spicing it up with brownies in the kitchen. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Dean Kinnetter. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday talk about brownies with Leah Hislop, author of the new cookbook, The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite style of brownie, a favorite brownie you've ever eaten, whether it was homemade, restaurant bought, or whatever? Do you have a question about how to make the best brownies? Are you baking some right now? I see ya. Tell us about them. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Leah, something that I've had to work on in my brownie game over time is how to tell when they're done. How they're fudgy but not raw. What tips do you have for us on telling when a brownie is done?
That is the ultimate challenge, isn't it? I think it takes practice. But I would say, first of all, get to know your oven. Does it run a bit hotter? Does it run a bit cooler than other ovens? Always recommend getting a temperature checker if you can. And if you know that your oven runs a bit hot, I would recommend you start checking maybe like 5 to 10 minutes before the recipe says, you know, it's going to be ready. You know, it's not like a cake. It's not going to sink. So it's safe to check. So that's a good tip. I usually take mine out when they have a tiny bit of movement still in the tin. You know, when you kind of shake it and there's just a little bit of jiggle in the center, because mm-hmm. they continue cooking as you take them out. So that's a good tip for me. And you know, the skewer test that you use for cakes, it doesn't quite work for brownies, but you can still do a skewer test. So if you put it in and you're getting kind of liquid batter, you know, that's not ready. If you put it in and it's dry, you've kind of overdone it. But if you're getting kind of like crumbs, you know, like chocolate crumbs, kind of moist chocolate crumbs stuck to it, I think that's usually a good moment for me to think that's probably about ready.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Madison. Joe, hello.
Hi, I have a quick two-part question. Has the guest ever heard of America's Test Kitchen? They have a recipe for a triple chocolate chip cookie, which I've used for years. And if you make it thicker, no one would know it wasn't a brownie. So the second question is, what is the difference really between a good chocolatey or fudgy, even chocolate chip cookie versus a double chocolate or triple chocolate cookie versus a brownie? And any thoughts on America's Test Kitchen? Thank you.
Joe, thanks for the call. We've talked to America's Test Kitchen a time or five on the show. Leah, thoughts on that border between a really chocolatey fudgy cookie and a really fudgy brownie?
I have heard of America's Test Kitchen. I don't know it well, but that is a good question, isn't it? I think often people refer to brownies as, in the US anyway, you guys refer to them as bar cookies a lot, which I think is an interesting phrase. You don't really have that in the UK. But I think it's about kind of, I mean, for me, it's just a question of kind of depth, isn't it? Like, I think a cookie is, you get a lot more surface, right? You get that kind of, the crust is kind of a lot of the main event. Whereas a brownie, I think you get that squidgy depth. Still the crust on top, but it's kind of a smaller part. So I suppose that's how I think about it. I'm not quite sure what the scientific difference would be. America's Test Kitchen would probably have a better answer for that.
We mentioned blondies just before the break, and Leah, you passed us along a recipe that we have up at WPR.org/Food Friday for first day on the job blondies. Can you tell us about these?
Oh, yeah. So this idea was that you start a new job and, you know, what do you want to do? You probably want to take something along that you can share out and, you know, win some new friends with. So that I designed a blondie for that. So something that you can carry, that it's, you know, it's not going to disintegrate, carries well in a Tupperware, and that most people are going to like. So it's a kind of a classic white chocolate blondie, but it's gently spiced with kind of like chai spices. So kind of like ginger, cinnamon, cardamom, love those flavors. And then it's got little squares of milk chocolate studded on the top as well. So you get that mix of milk and white chocolate, which I think is really nice and balances out the sweetness. It's probably my favorite recipe in the book, actually.
Again, you can find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got David with us in Oshkosh. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about your brownie habits, David?
I just love to make sure the edges are right. You know, I mean, you got to get the edges perfectly, not crisp, but just chewy, you know. And then I love putting marijuana in my brownies. I don't know if you guys do.
David, thanks for the call. We'll leave no comment on that one. But Leah, getting the edges of our brownies right, what do you think?
I'm going to say metal tin again. I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I really think that helps. It kind of conducts the heat enough, so you're going to get it. It just helps. Trust me. Metal tin all the way.
And earlier we were talking about some of the ways in your book that you get really creative with brownies. One thing that stuck out to me is there is a popcorn brownie in the book, Leah. Can you tell us, how can we incorporate popcorn into a brownie?
Oh, yeah. I was being slightly silly with that one. That's called my Netflix and chili brownie. so it's it's designed to be, you know, to have on the sofa on a date. So it's popcorn and chili kind of mixed in. I mean, popcorn works really well in brownies. I usually chop a bit and then mix it through the batter. And then once it's in the tin, I push popcorn into the top as well. You want to use that kind of crunchy toffee popcorn. I don't know what you call it in the US. But yeah, you want to use that stuff because it kind of does make sure it doesn't go soggy.
All right, we've got one more recipe you shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. This is, now we had the first day on the job blondie. Now this is the Lonesome Tonight brownies. So first of all, before we get to the recipe, what goes into your mind when you want a Lonesome Tonight brownie? What are you shooting for there?
I was just thinking, you know, like brownies are very cheering, aren't they? Like, I think they are one of those foods that just always cheers you up. So I wanted a recipe that was, you know, perfect for those days where, I don't know, you know, you've had a breakup or you've had a bad day at work and you just want comfort. But you also probably don't want to go to the shops, crucially. So it's kind of got lots of store cupboard stuff in it. Oreos and peanut butter, which I think, you know, the two comforting things in the cupboard, aren't they, at all times? So that's that one. It's very indulgent. But, you know, that's what you need.
We're talking with Leah Hislop right now, author of the new book, The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between. Leah, we talked about tips on how to find out when a brownie is done, ready to take out of the oven. What are some other roadblocks, common mistakes that people should be watching out for?
That's a good question. Obviously, yeah. So taking out at the right time is, I think, is the big one that a lot of people stumble upon. Using the right kind of chocolate, I think, is pretty crucial. I mean, I tend to use, and most of my recipes use, what we call here kind of like 70% dark chocolate. So pretty dark. And I just think that does give the best chocolatey flavor. Using kind of milder chocolate, I don't know why, but it just doesn't. Yeah, like milk chocolate, I love, but it just doesn't have the same impact in a brownie. So I would say, yeah, using good ingredients is kind of crucial. Salt, which I mentioned earlier, doesn't really make it taste salty, but if you just put, even if you can, you know, health allowing, if you just put 1/4 teaspoon in a batch, it just kind of makes all the flavors come together really nicely.
Now, Leah, Dean made some brownies yesterday and brought them in, but... or actually, you didn't make them yourself. Somebody else, but you were the transporter.
Credit.
True. Yes. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, one of our colleagues couldn't eat them because she's got to be gluten free. You've got an answer for that. What are the keys to making a gluten free brownie that people still want to eat?
Yeah, I've got a few recipes in the book for those kind of tricky moments. But yeah, gluten free. I did a lot of testing for this. I tried a lot of different flours. I mean, personally, I find that a lot of the kind of conventionally available gluten-free flours don't do much for me. They've always got a kind of slightly grainy texture. So for me, ground almonds is the secret. Ground almonds work a lot like flour, and they just bring a kind of lovely nuttiness. So I love using those. And the other thing that works well is corn flour, which, you know, I mostly use for kind of like thickening stews and things, but corn flour works quite well as well. It's because it's so fine, I think it doesn't have that grainy feel. So my recipe actually is a mix of ground almonds and corn flour, and that works well for me.
And on the other hand, Leah, are there ways to make a brownie a little bit healthier if we're watching out for that?
Yeah, just about. I mean, I've got a few in the book as well for that. So, I have got one called I Should Eat More Vegetables that has carrots in it, but it also has cream cheese frosting, so I can't really claim that one's much healthier. But yeah, I also have one that it's slightly lower on kind of sugar, butter, all that stuff. And that's got butternut squash in, which works really well. You can't really taste it. I guess it's a little bit like carrots in a carrot cake in that sense. But yeah, it means you just don't have to use quite as much sugar fat, and it gives it a nice kind of, it's got a kind of nice moistness to it, which helps in a brownie.
And I've also heard of substitutes like applesauce and I think even black beans in brownies. Is that something you've encountered?
You know, I've tried the beans. I tried chickpeas. I wasn't into it. I could taste it. But maybe it works for some people.
Leah, I got to ask. I mean, you like brownies, but you've been working on brownies a long time and presumably trying multiple incarnations of all these recipes. Did you hit a brownie wall at some point where it was like, okay, maybe enough with the brownies for a while?
Oh, yeah, there was a big wall. I mean, I wrote this book during the start of the pandemic. So it was like the first lockdown we had here in the UK. And I just went a bit mad, just like brownies all over the house. No one I could share them with except my husband. So like, you know, it got to this point where I didn't even know what a brownie was meant to taste like anymore. You know, I'd be like, should it taste like this? Is this right? So yeah, I definitely hit a brownie wall. I didn't eat them for a good 6 months after finishing the book, but thankfully I'm back on the brownie bandwagon now.
And have you gotten to revive some of that social aspect of the brownie? Have you gotten to start sharing them with people again?
I have, which has been really nice. And it's been really nice to see people's reactions and the ones they like. Yeah, because it's such an important part of cooking, isn't it? It's very strange to write a book like this in a vacuum, because food is all about sharing, and brownies especially are about sharing, I think. You know, you don't make them for yourself, do you? They're a tray bake. They're intrinsically shareable.
All right, Leah, it is a drizzly, kind of dismal day in Wisconsin today, or most of Wisconsin anyway. What kind of brownie matches that mood?
Oh, that is a good question. I would probably make what I call my tea and sympathy brownies. which are flavored with a little hint of tea, and they've got biscuits pressed into them. So they are very comforting.
Leah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it. That's Leah Hislop, a food and lifestyle editor and writer. Her new cookbook is called The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between. You can find a few recipes from Leah over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got we just talked about the Lonesome Tonight brownies, some peanut butter in there, the First Day on the Job blondies, like cardamom and cinnamon in that, and then your basic ultimate fudgy brownies. Okay, Dean, if you had to make one, which one would it be this here weekend?
I'm a bit of a fan of the blondies, Rob. I think I'm going to have to try those first day on the job blondies.
You know,
and some days feel like that anyways.
I forget about the existence of blondies, and then I have a blondie, and I'm like, these are really good. So yeah, I think I might go that way too.
Well, I will gladly transport them if they are made.
Start your day with great conversations each weekday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. On Monday, it's the State Capitol Report. Kate talks to Wisconsin's state forester about the health of our trees and our forestry business, plus a talk with Revenue Secretary Peter Barca about Wisconsin's financial picture as tax season wraps up. That's coming up Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Wisconsin is the center of the Lego universe this weekend with the Brick World Milwaukee event at the State Fairgrounds in Milwaukee County.
There's going to be a lot of Legos, Lego memories, demonstrations, and more. Now, Dean, were you a Lego kid?
I was. I had the Lego table, a very retro thing where the whole surface of the table was Lego texture, so you could build right off of there. It was a one-stop shop. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, so I had Legos as a kid, fairly distant memories, and it was just... There weren't really kits then. It was just like you had a bunch of Legos and you had to use your creative design powers to make Lego stuff. So I didn't do much with them. My kids were pretty Lego-y, but then, of course, there's the constant parent fear of you step on the Legos in the house.
Oh, it always hurts, yeah. I recently tried one of those Lego kits in adulthood here. I made the Aston Martin DB5 out of Legos. And I got to say, complex, but pretty fun.
All right, we're putting the pieces together. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.